Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
So let's eat in. I'm your host, Kathy Arway, and this is Roberta's Pizza. We're at the home of Heritage Radio Network. It's the muggiest, hottest, sunniest 5th of July ever. No, probably not ever. It's usually hot this time of year. But I hope everyone had a good time yesterday with a little firework action, maybe some barbecuing. And, by the way, today's sponsor is brought to you by Brooklyn Bowl, dubbed by Rolling Stone as one of the greatest places on earth. Brooklyn Bowl's timely blend of live music, food by Blue Ribbon, and of course, bowling. It's a perfect strike every time. Brooklyn Bowl is on 61 Wythe Ave in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, a short walk from the LRG. Check out brooklynbowl.com. That's our sponsor today. So we also have a couple of really, really exceptional guests today. We have Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs, and they are both the co-founders, writers, editors, cooks of food52.com. Who's a fan? Me. So thanks so much for making it out here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And congratulations on 52 recipes that you just have completed. And now, as far as I know, the concept of the blog or website was to have 52 winner, user generated recipes that kind of beat the other recipes out for best recipe of the week each week. Mm-hmm. So 52 weeks of doing this, you have the 52 winners and you're going to make a cookbook with those recipes, correct?
Yeah, we actually, so it was 52 weeks, a full year. And for most of the year, we were actually running two recipe contests per week. So we ended up with over 100 winners over the course of a year.
Oh, wow.
So we've got, enough for a real cookbook.
Yeah, that's great. So it'll be 104 recipes?
104 with a few others. It's actually more than that.
It's like 140.
That's
because
true.
We named wildcard winners, just recipes that people would upload to the site that were, sometimes related to the contest, sometimes just like their favorite recipes. We would sort of pluck them out behind the scenes and test them, ones that we thought looked great. And then we would award them a wildcard win. So they also get in the book. They get win a book and they won a prize. And so we sort of try to keep it a mix of the structured, weekly recipe contests with the sort of spontaneity of a wild
editor's
card.
Editor's
fave.
Cool. And did you cook every single recipe?
We did, indeed.
Yes. Oh, yeah, of course.
Often more than once.
Yeah. Wow.
So we test about 10 to 15% of the entries. We read every single one, and then we select 10 to 15% to try out. We test those, and then we choose two finalists. And then Meryl and I make them again for a photo shoot, and then often again for a video. So by the time they've become officially finalists, they're very well vetted.
Yeah.
Well tested too. Did you come up with anything that really didn't work along the way, or?
Yeah, I mean there are some recipes that didn't work in the testing, certainly the initial testing phase. And I think one of the reasons for that is that, and we've heard this directly from our readers, is that a lot of people just cook by feel and they aren't used to writing down a recipe. Mm-hmm. So when it comes time to translate what they have made a million times, without thinking about it to a recipe online, it's often difficult for them to come up with measurements. And so often it's sort of a proportion issue that ends up being.
Recipe writing is really an art form. And so it's even beyond the measurements, just, describing the look and feel. Some people, it's like they're so comfortable making their own recipe that actually, writing down all the little details that would be important for someone who hasn't made that recipe before, it's just not
or
obvious.
Maybe never worked with that ingredient before.
Yeah.
That technique.
Yeah. You find this a lot with chefs. It's sometimes hard for them to translate what they do into an actual structured recipe that accounts for every little worry that a person new to the recipe might have.
Right.
Yeah.
I definitely encountered that too, writing recipes kind of on the fly for my blog.
Yeah.
I'm like, guesstimation is a virtue. Just so you know, disclaimer.
Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
But it's amazing. Sometimes a lot of people will write in, they'd be like, oh, I did this differently, just on a whim, and it was great. So I hope people just do stuff like that.
Yeah.
Continually.
Yeah, we get a lot. Actually, our finalist recipes typically get, you know, upwards of like 30 or 40 comments. And often, you know, usually they're like, this is a great recipe. Mm-hmm. But often there are also other ideas, yeah, you know, or variations that are great to have. And there's some really good conversations going on.
It's a good forum.
Yeah.
So I know you're a bona fide, you know, expert recipe tester, Meryl, right?
Well, I mean, I went to cooking school and worked testing recipes at Cooks Illustrated initially. And then did some freelance recipe development for The Times and some other publications. So, you know, I have, I guess, recipe testing chops, but Amanda has just as many, if not more than I do.
Well, we tested more than 1,400 recipes together.
And there's that.
Yeah. I was working
for your cookbook.
Yeah, the cookbook that's coming out this fall. Yeah, so we've done a lot of recipe testing.
Yes, we have. Yes,
we've
together.
Spent a lot of time in the kitchen together, which is really great.
So the cookbook, by the way, is coming out in the fall. It's the New York Times, the best of the recipes.
Yeah.
What's the exact title again?
It's called the Essential New York Times Cookbook.
The Essential New York Times Cookbook.
Yeah, so it's a look back at their entire recipe archive, which goes back to the 1850s. And you know, and is a selection of the sort of most interesting, noteworthy, great recipes from it.
Throughout the years, throughout the 1850s. I can't imagine what those recipes must be like.
Excellent, a lot of them.
Really?
Yeah.
A lot more sophisticated than you might imagine.
That's great. I can't wait to see them. thank you for archiving and compiling everything from those years. And is it your own choice, kind of?
Yeah. Well, and a lot of readers wrote in about their favorites, and so that's how, like, Meryl and I formulated like what to test, because before 1970s we weren't around. So we needed some guidance.
Yeah, absolutely. So it seems like Food 52, and maybe what you mentioned a bit about how you chose recipes in the Essential Times Cookbook, it's very user kind of generated, and it's very power of, you know, voice of the people, audience, you know, chosen recipes. Why did you decide to have, first of all, Food 52? You know, a lot of people put up food blogs and recipe blogs, and it's their own, you know, favorites. But this is all really recipes from readers.
Well, I think, with the name itself, I mean, it was important to us that people understood that this was not like our personal blog. This is a place for everyone. And so sort of having a more kind of general name like Food 52, but 50, you know, we knew we wanted to do this 52, create a cookbook in 52 weeks. And so, and, you know, we liked, you know, names like the band Matchbox 20 and Area 51. And so we were sort of inspired by that, and we wanted 52 in it. And, you know, and food was nice and short and kind of got the point across. And it was also more general because it wasn't just, you know, recipes 52, or, you know, it sort of gave us some range.
And in terms of it being all, as you noted, user generated, or, you know, crowdsourced, the buzzwords, you know, basically, first of all, the idea for Food 52 really came from the New York Times project, because we made this observation while we were testing all of these recipes that were recommended by readers, that actually a huge portion of them were recipes that came from home cooks. They were printed in the Times, but they were actually recipes that did not come from chefs or even from the food writers themselves, but, you know, from, you know, someone who's famous for her apple cake or whatever, and just had her moment in the spotlight because Craig Claiborne decided to include her recipe. So that was sort of the genesis for this idea about giving, you know, a voice to these sort of individual experts who are out there, and as evidenced by all these food blogs. So in a way, we also took all the individual food blogs as inspiration, but we wanted to be at like a gathering place rather than just adding our personal voices to the mix. So sort of another platform for people.
And working with average folks or non-professional chefs' recipes, do you see any like notable differences between those and, like you mentioned, you know, chefs' recipes are very kind of hard to work through sometimes, and it's not as Do you see any differences in how that?
I think, well, one thing that leaps to mind that has it's so great is voice. Mm-hmm. People who aren't trained to write recipes for magazines in that sort of like kind of sterile magazine style, which, you know, is great because it's very clear and it's, you know, kind of universally clear. The thing is that when, you know, regular people write their recipes, they write them like they talk. And so they often, point out details or, you know, write funny little things like, you know, like I like to eat the leftovers right here. You know, I like to stand at my counter and drink a beer and have the like trimmings from the, you know, from the roast while it's, you know, the sauce is finishing and just all of that sort of lovely, kind of like narrative to how people cook at home, and it's really nicely distilled and captured in their recipes, and it's terrific. And of course, you know, yes, sometimes they leave out things like season the dish,
add salt.
But to us, the voice is so much more valuable than the kind of, you know, sort of scientific method.
Yeah, that's a great thing to preserve. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, you do get you see all these stories.
Any types of food that these home cooks are favoring, or maybe
smoked paprika?
Really.
Yeah,
and that pesto.
Yes, and pesto. Those are the ingredients of 2009 through 2010. It's funny. There really is a smoked pesto. Smoked pesto.
That would be good. Smoked paprika pesto. Let's make it
that
right
could
now.
Could work. Smoked paprika. It like got to the point where we basically had to say, "All right, enough. We're not like testing any more recipes that have smoked paprika in them, because otherwise the cookbook is going to be, you know, 50%."
Whoa, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, there are other little trends too. I'm trying. There's a lot of
ramps. Maybe.
Ramps. Yeah.
You know,
there's a lot of deep frying.
Yes, there is, actually, a surprising amount. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Which we both embrace.
Yes, we're happy to deep fry anytime.
Wow, I remember when I had come to shoot a video with you guys in the early spring, ramps were just coming around, and you guys were about to do a contest for ramps, and you weren't sure about how popular it would be amongst readers, but has it really taken off then?
Yeah, they were, and they continued to come in after submissions had closed for the ramps contest.
Yeah, so there's a real lust for ramps these days.
It's funny though, because actually the West Coast people were sort of bemoaning the fact that they don't have them, and they were a lot. Some people didn't know what they were, and others were sort of saying, "Oh, I wish, you know, wish it would be on the East Coast to have ramps." I never knew that.
Yeah, I didn't either. It was kind of a great moment for conversation around, you know, so the East Coasters kind of, you know, jumped in and filled in the West Coasters, and then, you know, occasionally the West Coasters would say, "Enough about ramps, I'm tired."
Do you have a good go-to substitute maybe for ramps? Or
that's tough.
You could guess mix, you know, garlic and leeks or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
Scallions maybe.
Yeah.
Shallots. Scallions
are a little sharp, I think.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. That's true.
What about shallots? I'm growing these shallots and they have like really big, but they're still like hollow shoots. Mm-hmm. Kind of like the tops are more like scallions. Scallions, mm-hmm. Scallions, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the bottom is this mild. Hmm. Especially when they're young. I think they're as small as ramps.
That could work.
Hmm.
Try it out and let us know what you think.
Well, you know, in Spain they eat wintered over onions. They call them calçote. And they eat them with this with romesco sauce in the springtime, and they just grill them. But they kind of, they look sort of like a wild leek.
That sounds
or,
really good.
Or, you know, like a big ramp.
So just move to Spain.
Yeah, so just if you could just move to Spain. That'd be great,
And then go at the right time when it's right, just wintered over.
Exactly.
Cool. So, Meryl, I know you chose a song to play. It's a friend's band.
Yeah.
We'll just have a...
My friend Abby Barrett is a singer-songwriter living in Cambridge. And we're going to play a song from her first album. And the song is called Shine a Little Light.
Cool. We'll be right back right after the song.
Got a little light now.
All right. Thanks for that song, Meryl.
Not at all.
We're back on Let's Eat In. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and today's show is brought to you by Brooklyn Bowl. They're sponsoring Heritage Radio Network. Thanks a lot. And we're at Roberta's Pizza with Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs from Food 52. We were just talking about the end of the, not actually the end of the project, but the end of the recipe gathering for Food 52's upcoming cookbook. What's it going to be called, by the way? Food 52?
Good question.
Well, that's a question that we actually need to talk with our community about, because they're going to actually take part in every detail of the sort of book production.
Wow. You know,
like the sort of decisions that get made along the way, like the title or the look of the cover and the font.
So maybe you'll crowdsource the title and the cover and the font.
Yeah, that's the idea.
That's terrific. I wish I had that when I was, I was crowdsourcing my friends. I'm like, do you like this? That's such a cool idea. So everyone has a bit more, I don't know, ownership, participation.
Yeah. I mean, we felt like it was a great opportunity to like sort of give people a chance to participate in this creative process that not that many people get it, you know, who love food get a chance to like create a cookbook. And so, yeah, we didn't want it just to be the content of the cookbook, but like the whole sort of, you know, packaging and even the way it will be publicized. You know, we'd love people to take part in. So, I mean, we think of, you know, Food 52 as really the community, not like us creating a cookbook with their stuff.
Yeah.
It's the home cooks of Food 52's cookbook, really.
Exactly. Yeah, that's how we want people to feel about it, because they really did all the work.
Too. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So it's going to be divided into sections like appetizer, entree, and all that stuff.
It's probably going to be chronological, just because we feel that the story of the 52 weeks is actually really fun, because, you know, when we started out, things were very different from how they are now. We had a much smaller audience, and our process was a little bit different. And, you know, we sort of got to know people along the way as they became part of the community. So we felt that there was some value in telling that story. And plus, it makes it seasonal if you do it chronologically.
Okay, so that's perfect.
And then, obviously, in the index, we'll have, like, you know, soups, salads, and so that people can navigate it in different ways.
That's interesting. So I bet by the end, it's sort of like the creme de la creme, because it's like sourced between so many more people than the end.
That's the idea.
Really, stakes are high. Cool.
Yeah, we really feel that no one person could create the kind of book that we're going to end up with over the course of a year, because, you know, the energy and the talents of the crowd is really valuable.
It's been amazing. I mean, we know when we started the project, we were betting that there were all of these really, you know, great cooks out there. And what we found is that, yes, that is in fact true, but there are really, the recipes have been even much better than we had hoped for. I mean, they're just sophisticated, they're interesting, they have soul, you know, there are dishes, you know, I feel like I will make for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
You know?
So it started with this hunch, and I think that's just fantastic, coming from two, you know, professionals in the food world, to just bring it back to the homes and see what's out there, what's cooking.
Yeah.
Is that really, what is the, so you came up with the idea together when you were writing the New York Times cookbook. And had you both done anything online before?
Amanda had
a blog.
Yeah, I had done a non-food thing. I had done an application for Twitter called Plot, which actually allowed you to track tweets. I happened to track things that I ate.
surprise.
Used it to my own person, but other people used it to, like, to track the miles they ran, or, you know, the oil prices or whatever. That was my foray online.
And I had done pretty much nothing online. I'd written for a couple of online publications, but certainly hadn't been behind the scenes. You know, had been in pretty traditional print media before that. So it was a real adventure for me. I learned a lot from Amanda.
Well, we've learned a lot together.
That's true. Well, you definitely started at a higher level than I did.
Well, I think that this is really innovating how food and recipes get published. So thanks for coming up with it. It's a really neat idea. Oh.
Thank you.
And what's next? Are you going to do another 52 weeks?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So this summer we're doing one contest a week, and it's actually sponsored by Whole Foods, and there's one ingredient a week, and the winners get $100 gift card at Whole Foods, and then one of the 8 winners will get $1,000 gift card. So we're gonna do that through the summer. Meryl's getting married in August.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
And then we're going to jump back in September and start a new book then.
Yeah,
great. I know you've had cookbook or potlucks centered around, you had this one cookbook contest a while ago. No,
the tournament, cookbooks last fall.
And we'll do that again. Yeah.
Yeah.
That should be really fun.
Yeah. Those are the potlucks and the piglet, as we call it, are actually not related, but they're both kind of cool things that have mm-hmm. grown out of this. So, the Tournament of Cookbooks, which we'll do again this fall, is basically an NCAA-style bracketed tournament of what we're calling, the most noteworthy cookbooks of the year. And we basically get all of these known voices in the food world to take 2 books at a time, cook a bunch of recipes from them, read them, and then sort of pick a winner for that round. And then whatever book they pick advances to the next round. And so you have this sort of... slow whittling down, and then you have a victor at the end, who gets the piglet trophy. Mm-hmm. And so we'll do that again this fall. But the potlucks, Amanda, do you want to?
Oh, yeah. So the potlucks were something that actually formed without us, which was great. So it was the people who were spending time on the site and kind of getting to know each other through the comments section and through the recipes.
Oh, wow.
Decided they really wanted to meet each other in person. So I can't remember who started the first one.
I think it was Antonia James. The Bay Area.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yep. And she organized a group of people who were in the Bay Area to come over to her house and each bring a dish. Or actually, they went to somebody else's house. But they each brought a dish. And, some of the recipes were from Food 52. Some of them were just their own personal mm-hmm. specialties. And they got together and, socialized offline, which to us was, perfect and great. And we, wished we could have gone to that one. And then it turned out that there was a few more formed, and including one in Central Park, which we were able to attend about a month ago. And it was, it was just fantastic to, because we really have developed relationships with people all over the country through their cooking and through the comment section, and to actually be able to break bread with them was a great treat. And I think that's sort of to us a great symbol of community, online community, is when you are inspired to actually meet offline as well.
Yeah,
it's really neat, and it kind of goes along with what you're saying. These recipes are very human. There's this personal quality about them.
Yeah.
And then you can actually meet in person and hang out and try each other's food. Uh-huh. So when's the next one in New York taking place?
I think actually there's been talk about doing one at the end of August.
Yeah.
Sort of around Labor Day.
Barbecue.
Yeah. So we'll keep you posted.
Cool. Well, what you do on the site, we have a meetup.com a meetup everywhere. So we have a little meetup widget where people are forming potlucks. And I think there are sort of 20 in the works at the moment.
Yeah. So go check them out if you're interested.
Great idea. And that's something that just totally happened organically.
Yeah.
Wasn't part of the plan.
Yeah. We did not come up with it.
Yes. That's what I find about a home cook or just people who love food, that it's all about sharing it too. Because who wants to eat it all by themselves?
Right. Food is inherently social.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's really something that Amanda and I have both always really loved and appreciated about it and about our jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be able to bring that to this sort of larger community has been really gratifying.
So there's been a lot of potlucks and parties going on lately, I'm sure. Backyards, now that it's nice out. What's your favorite potluck dish to bring lately?
It's an interesting question. I've been bringing a cucumber salad recently, which I'm almost embarrassed to even say what it is because it's so simple, but everyone seems to like it. It's just basically a German cucumber salad with sliced onion.
Red onions,
and I mix sherry and rice vinegar together and then put in my secret ingredient, which is caraway seeds.
Nice.
It's delicious. I've had it. You know, I just made a cucumber salad yesterday.
You did?
That is actually based on a Florence Fabricant recipe that ran in the Times, I think in the 80s. And it's just you slice cucumbers and you salt them and then you drain them. And then you mix sour cream, lemon zest, and lemon juice. Very simple. I love it. It's fantastic. But yesterday, I used Persian cucumbers. Have you ever used them?
I haven't used them yet.
I love those.
They're amazing.
They're so great. Yeah. They're like the size of
a cigar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And they're so crunchy and eat the whole skins.
Yeah. And they just have a lot of flavor, a lot of texture. And then I used preserved Meyer lemon that I had bought at Brooklyn Larder and just diced it up and used that in place of the like regular lemon zest. And it was just incredible.
That sounds
just
great.
Yeah, three or four ingredients.
That sounds really good. I'll have to get their preserved lemon.
It gets better
lemon.
As it sits. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but even if you just use regular lemon, and it's just the lemon and sour cream. It's this incredible combo.
So I made a cucumber salad recently that is kind of like yours, Meryl, but it was with toasted cumin seeds.
Oh, yeah.
And then some shallot and actually lemon juice instead of vinegar. Mm-hmm.
So we all like cucumbers. To bring cucumber salads to potlucks, apparently. So, if we're ever at a potluck together, we know what there's going to be a lot of.
Well, how about one of my favorite questions? What do you like to make for a most romantic date meal?
Mm.
I know you dedicate a whole book to this, Amanda.
You're the expert.
That book, again, would be Cooking.
Cooking for Mr. Latte.
Yes, there you go. I was going to say meeting Mr. Latte, whatever.
That would have worked too.
Yeah. Both of those things happened.
Well, I actually, my now husband, Mr. Latte, he always requests the same thing on his birthday, which I would say is his ideal romantic meal, which is this pasta rigatoni with white bolognese, which has just no tomato in it, and a chocolate cake with chocolate sour cream ice cream.
I think. Decadent. Pasta and chocolate cake.
Yeah.
Doesn't get much better than that.
What else do you need?
How about you?
Well, I feel like actually it's a fairly new recipe that I just, I think, made for the first time last summer, but it's become a real staple, and it's it always inspires us to light a candle and sit at the dining room table like, you know, human people. But I call it rosy chicken, and it's basically just a sort of slow stewed chicken thighs with cherry tomatoes and rosé wine instead of white wine, and some basil and, you know, whatever herbs you have around, and lots of garlic.
I love it. That even sounds romantic too.
Like, well, it sort of sounds. Yeah,
you should put a rose on the table and then maybe some rose petals or rose water.
Yeah, I'll try that next time.
Wow, that sounds really good.
Thanks.
Is it your own recipe that you just made it up?
I was inspired by a Jamie Oliver recipe and went way afield. I loved his original, which was just cherry tomatoes and I think basil. I've sort of forgotten at this point. And you cook it not in liquid. It's like more of a sort of roasting
tomatoes.
Thing. But the tomatoes all leach, you know, they're liquid. And then I added wine to it, and then I ended up putting it on the stovetop instead of in the oven. And then I added a bunch of other things, and it just kind of morphed into rosy chicken. So thank you, Jamie Oliver, for my most romantic meal. How appropriate, the naked chef.
Hey, I'll take tips from him anytime.
Yeah, me too.
He's a good guy. Cool. So it seems like that's just about all the time we've got, but I do want to mention that the Food 52 cookbook is going to come out in about a year. You guys are going to have, or Amanda's going to, and you worked on this book too, going to have the Essential Times cookbook coming out when exactly?
Late October.
Can't wait for that. Are you kicking off any crazy events, book party tours?
I think I am going to be hopping around a bit. I know I'm in San Francisco and LA and Chicago and Tulsa.
Exciting. You guys have an exciting year ahead of you. Yeah. You're getting married. I don't know how you had time to come here on the show, but thank you so much for making it.
Well, thank you
Our
for
pleasure.
Having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Cool. Well, hopefully see you again, and good luck in the meantime drafting up that book.
Always nice to chat with another great cook.
Oh, thanks. Anytime. I think our engineer just walked away, but we'll see you next week. I'd like to thank Jack Inslee and Nat Wiener in the control booth, and everyone at Heritage Radio Network and Roberta's Pizza. We'll see you next week. Thanks.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.